From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Ancient Mysteries. Here's what's happening. Tragedy in Italy. A motorway bridge has collapsed in the northwestern Italian city of Genoa, killing at least 26 people as vehicles plummeted to the ground. Dramatic video footage captured the moment of this disaster when one of the huge supporting towers crashed down during torrential rains. Vehicles and debris fell 148 feet onto rail tracks, buildings, and a river. Rescuers still there trying to free people. Jeez, can you imagine being stuck on a bridge and it collapses? Now, here's a story I wasn't sure if I was going to bring to you tonight or not. It is a national story. It is of major significance. It's not quite what we do here at Coast to Coast, but I'm going to go ahead with it anyway because, well, it's an important story. Several hundred Roman Catholic priests in Pennsylvania have been accused of sexually abusing more than 1,000 children, according to a grand jury report, in an alleged cover-up described as sophisticated by the state's attorney general. Over the course of a two-year investigation launched by the Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro's office, a grand jury heard several witness statements and pored over documents from six dioceses in the state. They included Allentown, Erie, Greensburg, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, and Scranton. Upwards of 300 predator priests stand accused of the decades-long abuse. Unbelievable story. I'm telling you, I was raised a Catholic, so I think I have a right to say this. The Catholic Church with this situation is under deep, deep fire. It really is. You mean to tell me that 300 priests who were predator priests roamed around Pennsylvania and the church did nothing about it and they didn't know about this? Hardly two people can keep a secret, let alone 300. Unbelievable. As tensions between the United States and Iran ratchet up, Iran has displayed a new generation of short-range ballistic missiles. The missiles, believed to have a range of between 500 and 800 miles, can evade enemy radars, they say. Iran is estimated to have over 1,000 short- and medium-range ballistic missiles. Dr. Jerome Corsi is with us. Jerry, this is not good for Israel, for sure, is it?
It's not, George, but I think Israel has the intelligence to be able to follow this and defend itself. What I'm concerned about is I think the sanctions are going to again cause the Green Movement, people in the streets protesting the government. And that's, I think, the next major story coming out of Iran, whether this regime will survive or not.
That's absolutely true, Jerry. And, you know, there's turmoil within Iran. Desperate people do desperate things, and I'm concerned that the Ayatollahs there may do something in order to stay in power.
If they do, George, it'll be the end of the Ayatollahs, because I think Israel is prepared, and I think the mullahs who are in charge of Iran know that any massive move to attack Israel will be their own suicide. Certainly with President Trump in power, that's the case. We've created CorsiNation.com, citizen journalism, and we're going to cover the videos and the stories coming out of the Iran protests. And I think in the next few weeks, that's going to be the major story.
Okay, and once again, give that new website out for everybody, Jerry.
CorsiNation.com.
You got it. Thanks. Dr. Jerome Corsi, whose book, Killing the Deep State, is still up there in the charts. A Colorado school district is attempting a million-dollar science experiment, cutting the school week to just 4 days instead of five. District 27J officially slashed Monday off the school calendar and started a four-day school week in a move designed to cut costs and attract teachers. But parents are concerned it will cost them money instead. Heck, if I were a kid, I'd rather have the Friday off instead of Monday. A blanket of red tide along Florida's Gulf Coast that's killing marine life, in addition to emptying normally packed beaches with an unrelenting stench, has caused the state's governor to declare that a state of emergency for parts of the region. Red tide is a naturally occurring toxic algae bloom that can be harmful to people with respiratory problems. It has spread throughout the region since October and stretches about 150 miles from Santa Maria Island to Naples. The algae turns the water toxic for marine life, and in recent weeks, beachgoers have discovered dead turtles, large fish, and even manatees washed up dead. 11 dolphins, too. A NASA robot is missing and presumed dead on the surface of Mars. Space scientists lost contact with the Opportunity rover almost 2 months ago as it was buffeted by a huge dust storm which covered the entire surface of Mars. Now, we've gotten our money's worth out of Opportunity. It was launched in 2004, so it's been operating for 14 years. Let's check in with author and researcher Mike Barra. We did get our money's worth out of this one, Mike, but do you think it's dead?
No, I don't think it's dead. It doesn't sound like it's dead, George. Actually, I mean, there's been a very intense dust storm, which is completely different than, say, a dust storm on Earth. The winds are much, much more gentle than you would expect, but it has probably covered the solar panels with enough dust that basically the Opportunity rover went into safe mode. Now, as the storm clears, and it is starting to dissipate now, the odds are that there will be more sunlight available, and if it's not too bad on those solar panels, it should get enough power to restart. So, we're, you know, I think the NASA people are hopeful, and I think everybody else is too, because it's been extraordinary. I mean, you send something up there for 8 months, and it ends up working 14 years later. Wow.
Yeah, that truly is. And with a dust storm, what happens? It gets dusty on the solar plant panels? Is that what happens?
Yeah, it basically blows a lot of sand around. I mean, the Martian soil is really a lot like sand at a beach, and if you had a big whirlwind come up and blow a lot of sand around, of course, it gets in everything, and something like a solar panel, which is, you know, just a very thin sheet, and they're not very big, of course, gets covered with enough of that reddish dust, and basically the light can't get through. And the thing is, George, these things were supposed to have been dead years and years and years ago, because everybody figured there would have been a dust buildup on the panels a long time ago, and this would have happened way, way back in 2004, 2005. In fact, they don't understand how these things have been still continuing to operate. It's really been a miracle. And the thing is that they've seen pictures. They've got pictures where the panels were actually covered in a lot of dust, and then weeks or months later, the dust was gone, and nobody knows how the dust was brushed off the panel. So if it happened once, I think we can remain optimistic it'll happen again. Maybe there's Marvin the Martian up there with a little dust.
You never know. Mike's website is MikeBarra, BARA.com. Michael, thank you so much. A new book, Blowing America's Mind, A True Story of Princeton, CIA Mind Control, LSD, and Zen, documents the experiences of two university alumni who were subjects in LSD and hypnosis experiments at the now-defunct New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute's Bureau of Research. We'll be talking next with Paul Davids about this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Noy with you. Now, before we get into this story about blowing America's mind with Paul Davids, because Paul was one of those hypnotized and pushed into the states of consciousness and altered states, I'm going to talk with him about some of his other work for a little bit. Paul is a graduate of Princeton University and the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies. He's been very active through the years in trying to end the official UFO truth embargo, and he took his efforts directly to former President Clinton on several occasions. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Mr. Paul Davids, it's always a pleasure.
Mr. George Noory, it's a pleasure to be back.
You are one of the good guys, my friend. You really are.
I like being in that camp, George, particularly with your recommendation.
Hey, before we get into this other incredible story, which you were part of, and, you know, you're on for a couple hours, so we've got a lot of time, let's talk a little bit about some of the other things you've done, because regular Coast to Coast listeners of the program will remember you as one of the co-producers and writers of the Showtime movie Roswell, the UFO Cover-Up. And that was an incredible movie. And tell me a little bit about that and how you got involved in that, Paul.
Well, that's right. The movie came out in 1994 on Showtime. I was executive producer and co-writer. And my first UFO sighting in broad daylight with my children was in 1987. And that catapulted me into research on UFOs, and I got to talk to Robert Wise about it, the director of The Day the Earth Stood Still. who was a believer and said that people came to him when he was making that movie from Washington and told him that there was more truth than fiction in it. And then he referred me to Roy Thinnes, who was the star of, I think it's called The Invaders.
Yeah.
Television series.
Blonde-headed actor, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think he played David Vincent, who investigated UFOs. And Roy Thinnes was fascinated by UFOs personally, in addition to being the actor in the series. And he came out to my house, and I walked through with him what my kids and I had seen in broad daylight. And he did a report on it that he sent to the Center for UFO Studies at that time.
Hynek's. That was Hynek's organization.
Yeah, J. Allen Hynek Center. Doesn't exist anymore, but it was really active for years, and Don Schmidt was their director of research. This resulted in Don Schmidt coming out to my house and walking through it. This daylight sighting really, really shook me up, and because it was so clear and, you know, sufficient in time. It was probably around 5 minutes. My daughter had seen it first, screamed at me to come upstairs and look at the flying saucer. I was a skeptic at that time. I hadn't really studied things, and my response was, you know, take another look. It's probably a Goodyear blimp. You know what those look like. I'm busy. I'm writing. Do I need to come upstairs? And she screamed at me to come upstairs. So I had that sighting. I learned about the Roswell incident, and before I knew it, in 1987, I was up to my neck in that research. I was being brought down to Roswell by Don Schmidt, and met a lot of the witnesses who were still alive at that point and heard firsthand from them. And there was so much certainty on behalf of so many of these people that this was an extraterrestrial event. And I got so many details from so many people. So I wrote a script based on a book that Don Schmidt was co-authoring at that time. And it finally got picked up after years of work. It got picked up by, well, first it was HBO. We thought we were going to make it for HBO. We were developing.
That would have been great.
Years. And then they killed the project, and we had to resell it to Showtime. But then we really got to make it, and Showtime gave us everything we needed, and we had a great cast. You know, we had Kyle MacLachlan, Twin Peaks. We had Dwight Yoakam, the country singer. We had Martin Sheen. And this thing was a big success for Showtime, and it was nominated. Roswell, the UFO cover-up, was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Television Movie. What's really interesting, George, what I want to make sure I don't forget to tell you, is that after the movie had its play, had its success, and it was big to do about it down in Roswell, and a fellow named Jim Courant, who you probably had on your show.
I think he's been on, yeah.
Yeah. He got me in touch with astronaut Gordon Cooper. He said Gordon Cooper had seen the movie, wanted to meet with me.
Well, who had his own UFO experience?
Numerous ones.
Yes.
Yeah. He wrote the book Leap of Faith. Excellent book. I mean, there was no question that Gordon Cooper was convinced that extraterrestrial contact had happened. And he called me to a meeting, and he was the first to orbit the Earth in a capsule. And he, I think, was Gemini.
No, it was
project.
John Glenn. John Glenn was.
Oh, John Glenn was wait a minute. Gordon Cooper was before.
He was one of the. Gordon Cooper with Glenn were part of the. Were the Mercury astronauts.
Well, first there was Mercury, yes.
But the first Gemini. One in space was Alan Shepard for us.
Okay.
But John Glenn was the first American to orbit the planet.
That was it, the orbit. And there was a big ticker tape parade for him with John F. Kennedy.
Yep.
In Times Square. So, you know, he had me to a meeting and told me he wanted me to know how accurate our movie was, that he had a lot of knowledge about this, inside knowledge, and he said we had hit it right on, that it was extraterrestrial, that this cover-up was real, it had been going on forever. He had tried to end it at the UN, didn't succeed. And later, Edgar Mitchell,
yep,
who walked on the moon, personally told me the same thing. This was real, this was extraterrestrial. So yeah, I'm very happy I was able to make that movie and bring a version of it to the public based on witness testimony. But it's been a frustrating couple of decades for me, George, since then, just as it has been for you, because we have so much information, and yet there's been snail's pace progress.
Yeah, we want the truth to come out, and it's just like pulling teeth, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, slowly there is progress. We know, and we hear your show. We hear people that you're interviewing. We know about the recent revelation of the Pentagon study. But that was, you know, that was the first movie that I was executive producer on with Stars, and it pretty much launched my career.
I mean, you ended up doing about 10 others, haven't you, or nine or 10 others? Yeah.
Yes, I've done 10 films now, five of them released by NBC Universal internationally to television, a number of them really controversial, and some of them have really had a resurgence, I must say. But, George, can I step back a moment? We've talked about Roswell. I just wanted to let everybody know a couple things going on right now.
All right.
Because it's been a year of resurgence for my movies, and also I'm in Santa Fe right now.
Well, by the way, I've got a buddy who's going to be in Santa Fe tomorrow for a week. I told him to look you up.
I hope he will.
Okay.
I certainly hope he will, because we have a second home in Santa Fe. I spend a lot of time here, and I've been painting all my life. When I'm not making movies, I'm painting. And I have a large body of work now, hundreds of paintings, and it's beginning to be really recognized. And here in Santa Fe, there's a gallery called Hu Shang's Gallery, which is right near the main plaza.
That's well known out there.
Yes. They've been in business 30 years, and Hu Shang is just opening a second gallery one block away from the first one. So he's doing really well. For somebody to have need to have two galleries in Santa Fe, that one of them isn't enough. He's doing a lot of business, and the new one at 110 West San Francisco Street, he chose my work to open the gallery with for the gala opening of, to have a show of a lot of my work. He chose 40 paintings, and it's going to start this Friday at the gallery. I'm going to be there Friday, Saturday. We're having receptions for any of your people who are in Santa Fe. And, you know, if they check my art website, which is linked at your
site,
they'll see a lot of the paintings that are going to be displayed. Some of these paintings would be of special interest to Coast to Coast listeners.
Are they kind of surreal?
Some of them are. You know, I did a series called New York Women, and I've always felt that New York women are going to take over the world eventually. They almost did. And I did a painting called New York Women in Space, and that one I think your viewers would love. Some of them have a surrealistic quality. The Dome of the Sacre Coeur, it's like you're peering into heaven. And you know, we heard about the Wounded Warrior Project as one of your sponsors, and one of these pieces is called Unknown Soldiers, and it's made of the uniforms of Marines, and it's done as an American flag. A few of them like that use extra materials, mixed media, I do with a partner, Russell Metzger, who is an artist in Albuquerque. We've actually done 24 pieces together that were at the Ritz-Carlton
for months
in Laguna Beach.
Did this start as a hobby?
Yes. Well, it started as a hobby. You know, I had training in art when I was a kid, but never considered that would be my profession. But after the LSD and hypnosis stuff at the Neuropsychiatric Institute we're going to talk about, after one of those traumatic experiences, I spent a summer in Vermont, University of Vermont, at a painting course. And things I did that summer were very surrealistic. And, you know, every year I would do a couple or a few paintings, and then it accelerated. Because in 1999, I made a movie about Vincent van Gogh called Starry Night, a fantasy. And the premise was, what if Vincent could return today and find out he's a success, not a failure?
Would he keep his ear? That's the question.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's part of the story, actually.
And, really?
He shows up in our time and finds out that his sunflowers, when he hears it sold for 33, He thinks $33 isn't bad. Then he learns it's $33 million. Well, I had so much fun making this movie I wrote, Starry Night.
Hold on for a second. We're at the break. We'll talk more about this. And also, you just came back from Italy. Let's find out why. We'll be back. Well, I'm watching the clock because we'll be in Asheville, North Carolina on Saturday, August 25th for our stage show at the Diana Wortham Theater. Now, there's one seat available on the bottom level. It popped up all of a sudden. Take advantage of it and grab it. That one is not going to last long at all. There's one seat in a great section on the bottom level. Everything else is up in the balcony. Great guests. And I really have fun not only doing the show, but singing with the band, but the meet and greet thereafter. That is fun because we pose for pictures and we do it all. And all the guests stay for that too. So how do you get your tickets? Just go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. At the top of the homepage, it says events. Click that. Or in the carousel reel where you'll see all those revolving pictures and the little buttons. Just hit one of those and it'll pop up there too. We are back with Paul Davids, co-author of Blowing America's Mind. We'll get into this incredible story of which he was one of the subjects back many, many years ago. We're going to pick up a few quick things here. Paul just came back from Italy. Again, he's got his art show coming up in Santa Fe. Full details at his website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. What did you do in Italy, Paul?
Well, I was invited to show Jesus in India there at the most fantastic, beautiful theater in Florence, Italy. And they put Italian subtitles on the movie, Jesus in India. It's a film I made about 10 years ago, and I've talked about it on Coast to Coast AM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Based on the work, book of Edward T. Martin, King of Travelers, Jesus' Lost Years in India. So I was really surprised by this invitation. You know, it just came right out of the blue. And it turned out that there is a West Meets East group in Italy that sponsored this. So my wife and I went over for this screening, absolutely magnificent. We had a full house. And this was on the same day that the movie about Han Solo, the new Star Wars movie.
The new Star Wars.
Yeah, opened. And the owner of the theater told us that, you know, that about a quarter of the number of people that saw Jesus in India showed up for Solo. So we had a great success there, and we had they had me do a panel and Q&A afterwards, and they served Indian food. You know, I filmed some of Jesus in India in Italy. I filmed at the Vatican. I filmed with Monsignor Corrado Balducci, and I know you've
heard of him. Oh, yeah. Remembered him. Yep.
Yeah, he was the Vatican spokesman who...
he was the ufologist for the Vatican, basically.
Yes, yes. He,
Paula Harris knew him well.
Yeah, he took the position that these things are not demonic, they're not fantasy, that they are real, that God made a lot of real estate in the universe, and that there are other beings here. Anyway, he gave an interview in it about Jesus in India, and I got to see, I guess you would call him the Pope of Hinduism. The title is Shankaracharya. He's the leader of like a billion Hindus. And I got to have an interview with him about this. I have the Dalai Lama in the movie, and Elaine Pagels, the biblical expert, Princeton University. So it's a really packed, controversial film. It showed on the Sundance Channel, and NBC Universal released it.
You didn't have a whole group of Italians run out of the theater screaming?
No, you know, because I think that with this West Meets East group, that it attracted those who were favorable to the possibility that Jesus was in India. I would have liked to have seen a lot of practicing Catholics there be exposed to this information and this this evidence, this incredible trail of supporting documentation that makes this a very credible theory. But that wasn't really the main audience. It was this supportive audience. But I want to say that trip to, I just got back recently, Italy, and then we went to Spain. And this followed on the heels of the Pasadena History Museum setting up a display called Dreaming the Universe about science fiction. And they had just taken my film, The Sci-Fi Boys, about the history of science fiction, to put in their Pasadena History Museum, and they're playing clips from it like 24/7. And this exhibit with all of this memorabilia of movie science fiction is going on into September, so people could check that out. And one other thing I want to tell you about the trip to Europe. I've always been an incurable fan of Ray Harryhausen's films. And the Sci-Fi Boys is partially about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he brought us Jason and the Argonauts and all of the Sinbad movies and the original Clash of the Titans. He brought us the first incredibly realistic stop-motion monster movies. And one of my favorites was always The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad from the time I was...
I used to love those. My dad would bring me to those.
Yeah, I've seen it maybe 50 times. Well, when my wife and I went to Spain, I told her before we went... I said, Hollis, I want to go on a search in Spain. I want to visit the locations where they filmed my favorite childhood movie. I want to find those places. And that was the basis of our trip to Spain. And it was incredible because we found three of the main locations. And we went to the Caves of Arta on Mallorca. We went to the Torrent de Paredes, I think it's pronounced, Sa Calabra, on the island of Mallorca. We went to the Brava coast of Spain, where they filmed the opening scene with the Cyclops on the beach there, and I was determined to find the very beach, the very cliffs in the background, and I did, and my photos show a perfect match, and I sent this to director John Landis, you know, who's one who loves this movie too, and he had emailed me back shots from the lobby cards of the movie that showed the Cyclops against the very cliff that I had photographed. So, George, I just had so much fun. And then I come back to the U.S. to go to Baltimore to the Fort Fest. And this is, you know, Charles Fort, Fortean phenomenon.
Oh, the Fortean, yeah, great
That's
stuff.
That's the basis of all paranormal research, Charles
yep.
Fort.
He was great.
So Susan Switek, who is the state director in Virginia of MUFON, she holds this Fort Fest, which is a meeting, a conference of devotees of Charles Fort. And she invited me to come there and show my movie, The Life After Death Project, and to talk about the book connected with that, An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death, which I wrote with Gary Schwartz. So that's been... You know, this year has been all that travel, the resurgence of the movie.
You don't stop, Paul.
You know, now the art show. And Blowing America's Mind, the book, came out this year after... It's a book I began soon out of college. And let me just say, I'm not 60 anymore. I just turned the other side of 60. So college was a long time ago for me. So finally coming out with Blowing America's Mind, which I wrote with John Selby, who lived through all of that MKUltra stuff with me, to finally get it out was such a feeling of relief and accomplishment that it's out there.
Good for you. And Amazon Prime has picked up some more of your films.
Yeah, that's important too.
It's
I'm glad
you
mentioned
for you.
It. You know, I did Marilyn Monroe Declassified. And that's on Amazon Prime now. And for anybody listening who's delving into UFOs, there is the UFO angle about Marilyn and Roswell and what JFK told her and a CIA document about that. See Marilyn Monroe Declassified. If you've got Amazon Prime, it won't cost you anything. And then they also put on Amazon Prime my sequel to Life After Death Project. It's Life After Death Project 2, Personal Encounters, and it has John Alexander in it, who I know has been on your show a number of times, Colonel Alexander. So that is there. And then there's a movie I made called Before We Say Goodbye, made in New Mexico and Mexico with a Hispanic American cast called Before We Say Goodbye. Love this little movie, which had a big play from NBC Universal on television in Mexico, Brazil. They dubbed it into Spanish and Portuguese. It never got a fair shot here in the U.S. But now it is on Amazon Prime, Before We Say Goodbye. It comes from the song by Rebecca Del Rio, who's a star of Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch film. And this one, I mean, you know, Catholics will love this film. The star of it is a Catholic grandmother who's so distressed seeing her children turn away from the religion, and she needs a miracle. And she believes in the Virgin of Guadalupe. And there's a basilica for Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City. She wants to make a pilgrimage there. And that basilica cooperated completely with my movie. They let my crew come in. Even while Mass was going on, we were allowed to film there. It was incredible, particularly when they're letting the guy that made Jesus in India go do this, you know?
Super. Now let's get into this incredible story
that
we talked about some time ago when your book came out, Blowing America's Mind. But there's been some updates. What's been the reaction from Princeton about all this?
That's a great question. Well, the best news is that the Daily Princetonian, which is the newspaper of Princeton, took it really seriously and printed a big article about it in the front page of the newspaper. They printed the cover of the book in color, and they did their own research, which was fascinating, to supplement and back up what we say in Blowing America's Mind. So here you have a situation where one of America's major universities, Princeton University, one of the oldest schools in the country, Ivy League, was connected with the CIA's mind control MKUltra projects. We know it for a fact. The New York Times published an article in 1977 when MKUltra was first exposed. They said that both Princeton and Columbia universities were notified of their cooperation with and participation with some of these top secret MKUltra.
That's huge.
And I was a student when this was going on, and toward the final years of it. But the irony was, what I participated in wasn't at Princeton. It was connected with Princeton. The doctors involved with it were involved with Princeton, and the psychology department at Princeton even gave course credit to my co-author for the research he did out at a place that was then called the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute.
And that was John Selby, right?
Yes, John Selby was my co-author. I went to Princeton with him. He's written 20 books since then. We lived through the most bizarre, strange, intense, incredible adventure together as subjects at the Bureau of Research at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute.
Were you a volunteer, or did they grab you?
We were willing participants. Although we weren't told the truth about what was behind it, we knew nothing of a CIA connection, which was later proven. So the purposes of it were withheld from us, and we were lied to about the purposes behind it and what they really wanted to do with us.
I mean, you were hypnotized. You were given LSD.
Yes.
You could have gotten killed, Paul.
I don't know what could have happened, but, you know, there is one Princeton student who committed suicide. After the book came out, we heard from one of his relatives, actually, and she said he was involved in the Institute research before you guys were there, and she said he really lost his mind. He was one of the best and brightest and extremely talented, and he had written a paper about LSD. She sent that to us, and he eventually committed suicide. I don't know what could have happened. My partner in the writing of the book, John Selby, was older than I was. He was in the program longer than I was. They wanted to make him part of the staff. He was a psychology major, and they wanted him to stay on. They were training him to be a research hypnotist. And when I was first being put under hypnosis, they assigned my co-author, John Selby, as my training hypnotist for me to learn to go into these deep trances that they needed. But I was young, you know, I was the kid there, and I didn't know what I was getting into. I was way over my head, but the head of the institute spooky place, by the way. I want to add that right now, that this institute is part of the book Weird New Jersey, and they shut it down years later. They changed the name of it to the Princeton or North New Jersey Developmental Center. There were about 100 buildings there. There were schizophrenic patients there who were living out their lives there. I mean, they had a cemetery there. These patients would die there, be buried there. But we were in the research building working under Dr. Humphrey Osmond, who was at that time really one of the two, I would say, most famous names in LSD research.
Did you like him?
Yes, I did. I did. I respected him. The thing is,
I mean, he must have known the CIA was involved in this.
Of course, he was taking money from them.
Uh-huh.
They were supporting it. Okay. And it was through a dummy corporation that the checks were cut. We have this in our book.
And you found out when? 10 years later?
Yeah, I found out 10 years later of the CIA connection. And Dr. Humphrey Osmond was an absolutely fascinating man. You couldn't dislike him. He's the one who coined the term psychedelic in the first place. And he had done research with peyote, with the Indians up in Saskatchewan.
Right. Ayahuasca, too? Did he do ayahuasca, too?
No, this was kind of before ayahuasca became really... No, ayahuasca is partially DMT. He didn't study DMT. He studied mescaline, psilocybin, which is the magic mushrooms, and
right.
LSD.
Okay.
So he and Timothy Leary, I think, were the main names in that kind of research at that time. And he was incredibly knowledgeable. But, you know, he had these research goals that were nefarious to some extent for the subjects.
I mean, but it seems like in his case, they supported him. With Timothy Leary, they ostracized the poor guy.
Well, they ostracized Timothy Leary. And by the way, I have to stop and say, I made a film, a biography of the life of Timothy Leary called Timothy Leary's Dead. And I made it with Timothy Leary the last year of his life.
I remember that. That's right.
But as far as ostracizing Timothy Leary, it's because he opened his mouth. You know, he got off the reservation. He told everybody to take it. He was promoting it. I mean, the psychedelic movement in the country at that time was being promoted by him. Osmond...
Nixon hated him, didn't he?
Oh, said he was the most dangerous man alive.
Yep.
But Osmond, by contrast, kept quiet, never went off the reservation. He had an enormous supply of LSD there. They cut off the supply of LSD in 1966. They made it illegal then. The research was all legal up till then. Well, when they cut it off...
Oh, they made the research illegal too?
Yeah, they made the research illegal. They stopped the research with psychedelic drugs in this country.
What were they looking for? What was their mission with the research, Paul?
Well, it's two different issues there, George. One is, what was the CIA looking for with MKUltra, and what were their larger goals? We'll talk about that second. But at the institute that I was part of, they were working to come to understand the difference between schizophrenia, paranoia, the psychotic states of mind, mental illness, the difference between that and what happens to a person under a psychedelic drug. Because originally these drugs were called psychotomimetic drugs, meaning they mimic psychosis. Osmond didn't believe that. He believed that you could achieve consciousness expansion with LSD.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But they used hypnosis. See, they didn't tell us when they gave us LSD.
How did they give it to you, by the way?
In a drink before.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right.
And we wouldn't know, you know, if we were having a placebo, if they didn't want us to know, we would be hypnotized.
Didn't you feel weird physically?
Oh, sure. Some of the times, of course. And they would give you hypnotic conditions intending to change your perception of reality, and they would study your behavior and your reactions and your feelings, and you'd be interviewed. So For example...
Hold on for a second, Paul. We're already at the top of the hour. We'll come back and talk more about this research project. Paul David's with us, Blowing America's Mind, a true story of Princeton, CIA mind control, LSD, and Zen.